Chapter 3. The Joy of Being Wrong. The Thrill of Not Believing Everything You Think. I have a degree from Harvard. Whenever I'm wrong, the world makes a little less sense. Dr. Fraser Crane, played by Kelsey Grammer. In the fall of 1959, a prominent psychologist welcomed new participants into a wildly unethical study. He had handpicked a group of Harvard sophomores to join a series of experiments that would run through the rest of their time in college. The students volunteered to spend a couple of hours a week contributing to knowledge about how personality develops and how psychological problems can be solved. They had no idea that they were actually signing up to have their beliefs attacked. The researcher, Henry Murray, had originally trained as a physician and biochemist. After becoming a distinguished psychologist, he was disillusioned that his field paid little attention to how people navigate difficult interactions, so he decided to create them in his own lab. He gave students a month to write out their personal philosophy of life, including their core values and guiding principles. When they showed up to submit their work, they were paired with another student who'd done the same exercise. They would have a day or two to read each other's philosophies, and then they would be filmed debating them. The experience would be much more intense than they anticipated. Murray modeled the study on psychological assessments he had developed for spies in World War II. As a lieutenant colonel, Murray had been recruited to vet potential agents for the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA. To gauge how candidates would handle pressure, he sent them down to a basement to be interrogated with a bright light shining in their faces. The examiner would wait for an inconsistency in their accounts to pop up and then scream, "You're a liar!" Some candidates quit on the spot. Others were reduced to tears. Those who withstood the onslaught got the gig. Now Murray was ready for a more systematic study of reactions to stress. He had carefully screened students to create a sample that included a wide range of personalities and mental health profiles. He gave them code names based on their character traits, including Drill, Quartz, Locust, Hinge, and Lawful. More on him later. When students arrived for the debate, they discovered that their sparring partner was not a peer, but a law student. What they didn't know was that the law student was in cahoots with the research team. His task was to spend 18 minutes launching an aggressive assault on their worldviews. Murray called it a stressful interpersonal disputation. Having directed the law student to make the participants angry and anxious with a mode of attack that was, quote, vehement, sweeping, and personally abusive. The poor students sweated and shouted as they struggled to defend their ideals. The pain didn't stop there. In the weeks that followed, the students were invited back to the lab to discuss the films of their own interactions. They watched themselves grimacing and stringing together incoherent sentences. All in all, they spent about 8 hours reliving those humiliating 18 minutes. A quarter century later, when the participants reflected on the experience, it was clear that many had found it agonizing. Drill described feeling, quote, unabating rage. Locust recalled his bewilderment, anger, chagrin, and discomfort, writing, "They have deceived me, telling me there was going to be a discussion when in fact there was an attack. How could they have done this to me? What is the point of this?" Other participants had a strikingly different response. They actually seemed to get a kick out of being forced to rethink their beliefs. One participant remembers, "Some may have found the experience mildly discomforting in that their cherished, and in my case at least, sophomoric, philosophies were challenged in an aggressive manner. But it was hardly an experience that would blight one for a week, let alone a life." Another described the whole series of events as, quote, highly agreeable. A third went so far as to call it fun. Ever since I first read about the participants who reacted enthusiastically, I've been fascinated by what made them tick. How did they manage to enjoy the experience of having their beliefs eviscerated? And how can the rest of us learn to do the same? Since the records of the study are still sealed, and the vast majority of the participants haven't revealed their identities, I did the next best thing. I went searching for people like them. I found a Nobel Prize-winning scientist and two of the world's top election forecasters. They aren't just comfortable being wrong. They actually seem to be thrilled by it. I think they can teach us something about how to be more graceful and accepting in moments when we discover that our beliefs might not be true. The goal is not to be wrong more often. It's to recognize that we're all wrong more often than we'd like to admit. And the more we deny it, the deeper the hole we dig for ourselves. When our son was 5, he was excited to learn that his uncle was expecting a child. My wife and I both predicted a boy, and so did our son. A few weeks later, we found out the baby would be a girl. When we broke the news to our son, he burst into tears. "Why are you crying?" I asked. "Is it because you were hoping your new cousin would be a boy?"
"No," he shouted, pounding his fists on the floor. "Because we were wrong."
I explained that being wrong isn't always a bad thing. It can be a sign that we've learned something new, and that discovery itself can be a delight. This realization didn't come naturally to me. Growing up, I was determined to be right. In 2nd grade, I corrected my teacher for misspelling the word lightning as lightening. When trading baseball cards, I would rattle off statistics from recent games as proof that the price guide was valuing players inaccurately. My friends found this annoying and started calling me Mr. Facts. It got so bad that one day my best friend announced that he wouldn't talk to me until I admitted I was wrong. It was the beginning of my journey to become more accepting of my own fallibility. In a classic paper, sociologist Murray Davis argued that when ideas survive, it's not because they're true, it's because they're interesting. What makes an idea interesting is that it challenges our weakly held opinions. For example, did you know that the moon might originally have formed inside a vaporous earth out of magma rain? Or that a narwhal's tusk is actually a tooth? When an idea or assumption doesn't matter deeply to us, we're often excited to question it. The natural sequence of emotions is surprise, really? Followed by curiosity, tell me more, and thrill, whoa. To paraphrase a line attributed to Isaac Asimov, great discoveries often begin not with eureka, but with, that's funny. When a core belief is questioned, though, we tend to shut down rather than open up. It's as if there's a miniature dictator living inside our heads, controlling the flow of facts to our minds, much like Kim Jong-un controls the press in North Korea. The technical term for this in psychology is the totalitarian ego, and its job is to keep out threatening information. It's easy to see how an inner dictator comes in handy when someone attacks our character or intelligence. Those kinds of personal affronts threaten to shatter aspects of our identities that are important to us and might be difficult to change. The totalitarian ego steps in like a bodyguard for our minds, protecting our self-image by feeding us comforting lies. They're all just jealous. You're really, really ridiculously good-looking. You're on the verge of inventing the next pet rock. As physicist Richard Feynman quipped, you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. Our inner dictator also likes to take charge when our deeply held opinions are threatened. In the Harvard study of attacking students' worldviews, the participant who had the strongest negative reaction was codenamed Lawful. He came from a blue-collar background and was unusually precocious, having started college at 16 and joined the study at 17. One of his beliefs was that technology was harming civilization, and he became hostile when his views were questioned. Lawful went on to become an academic, and when he penned his magnum opus, it was clear that he hadn't changed his mind. His concerns about technology had only intensified. Quote, the Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. They have greatly increased the life expectancy of those of us who live in advanced countries, but they have destabilized society, have made life unfulfilling, have subjected human beings to indignities, to physical suffering as well, and have inflicted severe damage on the natural world. That kind of conviction is a common response to threats. Neuroscientists find that when our core beliefs are challenged, it can trigger the amygdala, the primitive lizard brain that breezes right past cool rationality and activates a hot fight-or-flight response. The anger and fear are visceral. It feels as if we've been punched in the mind. The totalitarian ego comes to the rescue with mental armor. We become preachers or prosecutors, striving to convert or condemn the unenlightened. As journalist Elizabeth Colbert writes, quote, presented with someone else's argument, we're quite adept at spotting the weaknesses. But the positions we're blind about are our own. I find this odd because we weren't born with our opinions. Unlike our height or raw intelligence, we have full control over what we believe is true. We choose our views, and we can choose to rethink them anytime we want. This should be a familiar task because we have a lifetime of evidence that we're wrong on a regular basis. I was sure I'd finish a draft of this chapter by Friday. I was certain the cereal with the toucan on the box was Fruit Loops, but I just noticed the box says F-R-O-O-T Loops. How did I never notice that? I was sure I put the milk back in the fridge last night, but strangely, it's sitting on the counter this morning. The inner dictator manages to prevail by activating an overconfidence cycle. First, our wrong opinions are shielded in filter bubbles, where we feel pride when we see only information that supports our convictions. Then our beliefs are sealed in echo chambers, where we hear only from people who intensify and validate them. Although the resulting fortress can appear impenetrable, there's a growing community of experts who are determined to break through. Not long ago, I gave a speech at a conference about my research on givers, takers, and matchers. I was studying whether generous, selfish, or fair people were more productive in jobs like sales and engineering. One of the attendees was Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize-winning psychologist who spent much of his career demonstrating how flawed our intuitions are. He told me afterward that he was surprised by my finding that givers had higher rates of failure than takers and matchers, but higher rates of success too. When you read a study that surprises you, how do you react? Many people would get defensive, searching for flaws in the study's design or the statistical analysis. Danny did the opposite. His eyes lit up and a huge grin appeared on his face. He said, "That was wonderful. I was wrong." Later, I sat down with Danny for lunch and asked him about his reaction. It looked a lot to me like the joy of being wrong. His eyes twinkled as if he was having fun. He said that in his 85 years, no one had pointed that out before, but yes, he genuinely enjoys discovering that he was wrong because it means he is now less wrong than before. I knew the feeling. In college, what first attracted me to social science was reading studies that clashed with my expectations. I couldn't wait to tell my roommates about all the assumptions I'd been rethinking. In my first independent research project, I tested some predictions of my own, and more than a dozen of my hypotheses turned out to be false. It was a major lesson in intellectual humility, but I wasn't devastated. I felt an immediate rush of excitement. Discovering I was wrong felt joyful because it meant I'd learned something. As Danny told me, being wrong is the only way I feel sure I've learned anything. Danny isn't interested in preaching, prosecuting, or politicking. He's a scientist devoted to the truth. When I asked him how he stays in that mode, he said he refuses to let his beliefs become part of his identity. He explained, "I change my mind at a speed that drives my collaborators crazy. My attachment to my ideas is provisional. There's no unconditional love for them." Attachment. That's what keeps us from recognizing when our opinions are off the mark and rethinking them. To unlock the joy of being wrong, we need to detach. I've learned that two kinds of detachment are especially useful: detaching your present from your past and detaching your opinions from your identity. Let's start with detaching your present from your past. In the moment, separating your past self from your current self can be unsettling. Even positive changes can lead to negative emotions. Evolving your identity can leave you feeling derailed and disconnected. Over time, though, rethinking who you are appears to become mentally healthy, as long as you can tell a coherent story about how you got from past to present you. In one study, when people felt detached from their past selves, they became less depressed over the course of the year. When you feel as if your life is changing direction and you're in the process of shifting who you are, it's easier to walk away from foolish beliefs you once held. My past self was Mr. Facts. I was too fixated on knowing. Now I'm more interested in finding out what I don't know. As Bridgewater founder Ray Dalio told me, if you don't look back at yourself and think, "Wow, how stupid I was a year ago," then you must not have learned much in the last year. The second kind of detachment is separating your opinions from your identity. I'm guessing you wouldn't want to see a doctor whose identity is professional lobotomist, send your kids to a teacher whose identity is corporal punisher, or live in a town where the police chief's identity is stop and frisker. Once upon a time, all of these practices were seen as reasonable and effective. Most of us are accustomed to defining ourselves in terms of our beliefs, ideas, and ideologies. This can become a problem when it prevents us from changing our minds as the world changes and knowledge evolves. Our opinions can become so sacred that we grow hostile to the mere thought of being wrong, and the totalitarian ego leaps in to silence counterarguments, squash contrary evidence, and close the door on learning. Who you are should be a question of what you value, not what you believe. Values are your core principles in life. They might be excellence and generosity, freedom and fairness, or security and integrity. Basing your identity on these kinds of principles enables you to remain open-minded about the best ways to advance them. You want the doctor whose identity is protecting health, the teacher whose identity is helping students learn, and the police chief whose identity is promoting safety and justice. When they define themselves by values rather than opinions, they buy themselves the flexibility to update their practices in light of new evidence. On my quest to find people who enjoy discovering they were wrong, a trusted colleague told me I had to meet Jean-Pierre Bougams. He's in his late 40s, and he's the sort of person who's honest to a fault. He tells the truth even if it hurts. When his son was a toddler, they were watching a space documentary together, and Jean-Pierre casually mentioned that the sun would one day turn into a red giant and engulf the Earth. His son was not amused. Between tears, he cried, "But I love this planet." Jean-Pierre felt so terrible that he decided to bite his tongue instead of mentioning threats that could prevent the Earth from even lasting that long. Back in the 1990s, Jean-Pierre had a hobby of collecting the predictions that pundits made on the news and scoring his own forecasts against them. Eventually, he started competing in forecasting tournaments, international contests hosted by Good Judgment, where people try to predict the future. It's a daunting task. There's an old saying that historians can't even predict the past. A typical tournament draws thousands of entrants from around the world to anticipate big political, economic, and technological events. The questions are time-bound, with measurable specific results. Will the current president of Iran still be in office in 6 months? Which soccer team will win the next World Cup? In the following year, will an individual or a company face criminal charges for an accident involving a self-driving vehicle? Participants don't just answer yes or no. They have to give their odds. It's a systematic way of testing whether they know what they don't know. They get scored months later on accuracy and calibration, earning points not just for giving the right answer, but also for having the right level of conviction. The best forecasters have confidence in their predictions that come true and doubt in their predictions that prove false. On November 18th, 2015, Jean-Pierre registered a prediction that stunned his opponents. A day earlier, a new question had popped up in an open forecasting tournament. In July 2016, who would win the U.S. Republican presidential primary? The options were Jeb Bush, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Carly Fiorina, Marco Rubio, Donald Trump, and none of the above. With 8 months to go before the Republican National Convention, Trump was largely seen as a joke. His odds of becoming the Republican nominee were only 6%, according to Nate Silver, the celebrated statistician behind the website 538. When Jean-Pierre peered into his crystal ball, though, he decided Trump had a 68% chance of winning. Jean-Pierre didn't just excel in predicting the results of American events. His Brexit forecasts hovered in the 50% range when most of his competitors thought the referendum had little chance of passing. He successfully predicted that the incumbent would lose a presidential election in Senegal, even though the base rates of re-election were extremely high and other forecasters were expecting a decisive win. And he had, in fact, pegged Trump as the favorite long before pundits and pollsters even considered him a viable contender. Early on, back in 2015, Jean-Pierre wrote that it was striking that so many forecasters are, quote, still in denial about his chances. Based on his performance, Jean-Pierre might be the world's best election forecaster. His advantage? He thinks like a scientist. He's passionately dispassionate. At various points in his life, Jean-Pierre has changed his political ideologies and religious beliefs. He doesn't come from a polling or statistics background. He's a military historian, which means he has no stake in the way things have always been done in forecasting. the statisticians were attached to their views about how to aggregate polls. Jean-Pierre paid more attention to factors that were hard to measure and overlooked. For Trump, he wrote that those included mastery at manipulating the media, name recognition, and a winning issue, i.e. immigration and the wall. Even if forecasting isn't your hobby, there's a lot to be learned from studying how forecasters like Jean-Pierre form their opinions. My colleague Phil Tetlock finds that forecasting skill is less a matter of what we know than of how we think. When he and his collaborators studied a host of factors that predict excellence in forecasting, grit and ambition didn't rise to the top. Neither did intelligence, which came in second. There was another factor that had roughly triple the predictive power of brain power. The single most important driver of forecasters' success was how often they updated their beliefs. The best forecasters went through more rethinking cycles. They had the confident humility to doubt their judgments and the curiosity to discover new information that led them to revise their predictions. A key question here is how much rethinking is necessary. Although the sweet spot will always vary from one person and situation to the next, the averages can give us a clue. A few years into their tournaments, typical competitors updated their predictions about twice per question. The super forecasters updated their predictions more than four times per question. Think about how manageable that is. Better judgment doesn't necessarily require hundreds or even dozens of updates. Just a few more efforts at rethinking can move the needle. It's also worth noting, though, how unusual that level of rethinking is. How many of us can even remember the last time we admitted being wrong and revised our opinions accordingly? As journalist Catherine Schultz observes, although small amounts of evidence are sufficient to make us draw conclusions, they are seldom sufficient to make us revise them. That's where the best forecasters excelled. They were eager to think again. They saw their opinions more as hunches than as truths, as possibilities to entertain rather than facts to embrace. They questioned ideas before accepting them, and they were willing to keep questioning them even after accepting them. They were constantly seeking new information and better evidence, especially disconfirming evidence. On Seinfeld, George Costanza famously said, "It's not a lie if you believe it." I might add that it doesn't become the truth just because you believe it. It's a sign of wisdom to avoid believing every thought that enters your mind. It's a mark of emotional intelligence to avoid internalizing every feeling that enters your heart. Another of the world's top forecasters is Kirsty Morrell. She's obviously bright. She has a doctorate from MIT in mechanical engineering. But her academic and professional experience wasn't exactly relevant to predicting world events. Her background was in human hip joint mechanics, designing better shoes, and building robotic wheelchairs. When I asked Kirsty what made her so good at forecasting, she replied, "There's no benefit to me for being wrong for longer. It's much better if I change my beliefs sooner. And it's a good feeling to have that sense of a discovery, that surprise. I would think people would enjoy that." Kirsty hasn't just figured out how to erase the pain of being wrong. She's transformed it into a source of pleasure. She landed there through a form of classical conditioning, like when Pavlov's dog learned to salivate at the sound of a bell. If being wrong repeatedly leads us to the right answer, the experience of being wrong itself can become joyful. That doesn't mean we'll enjoy it every step of the way. One of Kirsty's biggest misses was her forecast for the 2016 U.S. presidential election, when she bet on Hillary Clinton to beat Donald Trump. Since she wasn't a Trump supporter, the prospect of being wrong was painful. It was too central to her identity. She knew a Trump presidency was possible, but she didn't want to think it was probable, so she couldn't bring herself to forecast it. That was a common mistake in 2016. Countless experts, pollsters, and pundits underestimated Trump and Brexit because they were too emotionally invested in their past predictions and identities. If you want to be a better forecaster today, it helps to let go of your commitment to the opinions you held yesterday. Just wake up in the morning, snap your fingers, and decide you don't care. It doesn't matter who's president or what happens to your country. The world is unjust, and the expertise you spent decades developing is obsolete. It's a piece of cake, right? About as easy as willing yourself to fall out of love. Somehow, Jean-Pierre Bougams managed to pull it off. When Donald Trump first declared his candidacy in the spring of 2015, Jean-Pierre gave him only a 2% chance of becoming the nominee. As Trump began rising in the August polls, Jean-Pierre was motivated to question himself. He detached his present from his past, acknowledging that his original prediction was understandable, given the information he had at the time. Detaching his opinions from his identity was harder. Jean-Pierre didn't want Trump to win, so it would have been easy to fall into the trap of desirability bias. He overcame it by focusing on a different goal. He explained to me, "I wasn't so attached to my original forecast because of the desire to win, the desire to be the best forecaster." He still had a stake in the outcome he actually preferred, but he had an even bigger stake in not making a mistake. His values put truth above tribe. Quote, "If the evidence strongly suggests that my tribe is wrong on a particular issue, then so be it. I consider all of my opinions tentative. When the facts change, I change my opinions." Research suggests that identifying even a single reason why we might be wrong can be enough to curb overconfidence. Jean-Pierre went further. He made a list of all the arguments that pundits were making about why Trump couldn't win and went looking for evidence that they and he were wrong. He found that evidence within the polls. In contrast with widespread claims that Trump was a factional candidate with narrow appeal, Jean-Pierre saw that Trump was popular across key Republican demographic groups. By mid-September, Jean-Pierre was an outlier, putting Trump's odds of becoming the nominee over 50%. He advises, "Accept the fact that you're going to be wrong. Try to disprove yourself. When you're wrong, it's not something to be depressed about. Say, hey, I discovered something." As prescient as Jean-Pierre's bet on Trump was, he still had trouble sticking to it in the face of his feelings. In the spring of 2016, he identified the media coverage of Hillary Clinton's emails as a red flag and kept predicting a Trump victory for 2 months more. By the summer, though, as he contemplated the impending possibility of a Trump presidency, he found himself struggling to sleep at night. He changed his forecast to Clinton. Looking back, Jean-Pierre isn't defensive about his decision. He freely admits that despite being an experienced forecaster, he made the rookie mistake of falling victim to desirability bias, allowing his preference to cloud his judgment. He focused on the forces that would enable him to predict a Clinton win because he desperately wanted a Trump loss. He says, "That was just a way of me trying to deal with this unpleasant forecast I had issued." Then he does something unexpected. He laughs at himself. If we're insecure, we make fun of others. If we're comfortable being wrong, we're not afraid to poke fun at ourselves. Laughing at ourselves reminds us that although we might take our decisions seriously, we don't have to take ourselves too seriously. Research suggests that the more frequently we make fun of ourselves, the happier we tend to be. Instead of beating ourselves up about our mistakes, we can turn some of our past misconceptions into sources of present amusement. Being wrong won't always be joyful. The path to embracing mistakes is full of painful moments, and we handle those moments better when we remember they're essential for progress. But if we can't learn to find occasional glee in discovering we were wrong, it will be awfully hard to get anything right. I've noticed a paradox in great scientists and super forecasters. The reason they're so comfortable being wrong is that they're terrified of being wrong. What sets them apart is the time horizon. They're determined to reach the correct answer in the long run, and they know that means they have to be open to stumbling, backtracking, and rerouting in the short run. They shun rose-colored glasses in favor of a sturdy mirror. The fear of missing the mark next year is a powerful motivator to get a crystal-clear view of last year's mistakes. As Jeff Bezos says, people who are right a lot listen a lot, and they change their mind a lot. If you don't change your mind frequently, you're going to be wrong a lot. Jean-Pierre Bougams has a favorite trick for catching himself when he's wrong. When he makes a forecast, he also makes a list of the conditions in which it should hold true, as well as the conditions under which he would change his mind. He explains that this keeps him honest, preventing him from getting attached to a bad prediction. What forecasters do in tournaments is good practice in life. When you form an opinion, ask yourself what would have to happen to prove it false. Then keep track of your views so you can see when you were right, when you were wrong, and how your thinking has evolved. As Jean-Pierre says, I started out just wanting to prove myself. Now I want to improve myself, to see how good I can get. It's one thing to admit to ourselves that we've been wrong. It's another thing to confess that to other people. Even if we manage to overthrow our inner dictator, we run the risk of facing outer ridicule. In some cases, we fear that if others find out we were wrong, it could destroy our reputations. How do people who accept being wrong cope with that? In the early 1990s, the British physicist Andrew Lyon published a major discovery in the world's most prestigious science journal. He presented the first evidence that a planet could orbit a neutron star, a star that had exploded into a supernova. Several months later, while preparing to give a presentation at an astronomy conference, he noticed that he hadn't adjusted for the fact that the Earth moves in an elliptical orbit, not a circular one. He was embarrassingly, horribly wrong. The planet he had discovered didn't exist. In front of hundreds of colleagues, Andrew walked onto the ballroom stage and admitted his mistake. When he finished his confession, the room exploded into a standing ovation. One astrophysicist called it the most honorable thing I've ever seen. Andrew Lyon is not alone. Psychologists find that admitting we were wrong doesn't make us look less competent. It's a display of honesty and a willingness to learn. Although scientists believe it will damage their reputation to admit that their studies failed to replicate, the reverse is true. They're judged more favorably if they acknowledge the new data rather than deny them. After all, as the actor Will Smith has said, it doesn't matter whose fault it is that something is broken if it's your responsibility to fix it. Taking responsibility is taking your power back. When we find out we might be wrong, a standard defense is, I'm entitled to my opinion. I'd like to modify that. Yes, we're entitled to hold opinions inside our own heads. If we choose to express them out loud, though, I think it's our responsibility to ground them in logic and facts, share our reasoning with others, and change our minds when better evidence emerges. This philosophy takes us back to the Harvard students who had their worldviews attacked in that unethical study by Henry Murray. If I had to guess, I'd say the students who enjoyed the experience had a mindset similar to that of great scientists and super forecasters. They saw challenges to their opinions as an exciting opportunity to develop and evolve their thinking. The students who found it stressful didn't know how to detach. Their opinions were their identities. An assault on their worldviews was a threat to their very sense of self. Their inner dictator rushed in to protect them. Take it from the student with the code name Lawful. He felt he had been damaged emotionally by the study. 4 decades later, Lawful reflected, "Our adversary in the debate subjected us to various insults. It was a highly unpleasant experience." Today, Lawful has a different code name, one that's familiar to most Americans. He's known as the Unabomber. Ted Kaczynski became a math professor turned anarchist and domestic terrorist. He mailed bombs that killed 3 people and injured 23 more. An 18-year-long FBI investigation culminated in his arrest after the New York Times and the Washington Post published his manifesto and his brother recognized his writing. He is now serving life in prison without parole. The excerpt I quoted earlier was from Kaczynski's manifesto. If you read the entire document, you're unlikely to be unsettled by the content or the structure. What's disturbing is the level of conviction. Kaczynski displays little consideration of alternative views, barely a hint that he might be wrong. Consider just some of the opening lines. "The Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. They have destabilized society, have made life unfulfilling. The continued development of technology will worsen the situation. It will certainly subject human beings to greater indignities and inflict greater damage on the natural world. If the system survives, the consequences will be inevitable. There is no way of reforming or modifying the system." Kaczynski's case leaves many questions about his mental health unanswered. Still, I can't help but wonder, if he had learned to question his opinions, would he still have been able to justify resorting to violence? If he had developed the capacity to discover that he was wrong, would he still have ended up doing something so wrong? Every time we encounter new information, we have a choice. We can attach our opinions to our identities and stand our ground in the stubbornness of preaching and prosecuting. Or we can operate more like scientists, defining ourselves as people committed to the pursuit of truth, even if it means proving our own views wrong. Chapter 4, The Good Fight Club, The Psychology of Constructive Conflict. Arguments are extremely vulgar, for everybody in good society holds exactly the same opinions. Oscar Wilde. As the two youngest boys in a big family, the bishop's sons did everything together. They launched a newspaper and built their own printing press together. They opened a bicycle shop and then started manufacturing their own bikes together. And after years of toiling away at a seemingly impossible problem, they invented the first successful airplane together. Wilbur and Orville Wright first caught the flying bug when their father brought home a toy helicopter. After it broke, they built one of their own. As they advanced from playing together to working together to rethinking human flight together, there was no trace of sibling rivalry between them. Wilbur even said they thought together. Even though it was Wilbur who launched the project, the brothers shared equal credit for their achievement. When it came time to decide who would pilot their historic flight at Kitty Hawk, they just flipped a coin. New ways of thinking often spring from old bonds. The comedic chemistry of Tina Fey and Amy Poehler can be traced back to their early 20s, when they immediately hit it off in an improv class. The musical harmony of the Beatles started even earlier, when they were in high school. Just minutes after a mutual friend introduced them, Paul McCartney was teaching John Lennon how to tune a guitar. Ben and Jerry's ice cream grew out of a friendship between the two founders that began in seventh grade gym class. It seems that to make progress together, we need to be in sync. But the truth, like all truths, is more complicated. One of the world's leading experts on conflict is an organizational psychologist in Australia named Karen Eddie Jen. When you think about conflict, you're probably picturing what Eddie calls relationship conflict, personal emotional clashes that are filled not just with friction, but also with animosity. I hate your stinking guts! I'll use small words so that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon. You bob for apples in the toilet, and you like it. But Eddie has identified another flavor called task conflicts, clashes about ideas and opinions. We have task conflict when we're debating whom to hire, which restaurant to pick for dinner, or whether to name our child Gertrude or Quasar. The question is whether the two types of conflict have different consequences. A few years ago, I surveyed hundreds of new teams in Silicon Valley on conflict several times during their first 6 months working together. Even if they argued constantly and agreed on nothing else, they agreed on what kind of conflict they were having. When their projects were finished, I asked their managers to evaluate each team's effectiveness. The teams that performed poorly started with more relationship conflict than task conflict. They entered into personal feuds early on and were so busy disliking one another that they didn't feel comfortable challenging one another. It took months for many of the teams to make real headway on their relationship issues, and by the time they did manage to debate key decisions, it was often too late to rethink their directions. What happened in the high-performing groups? As you might expect, they started with low relationship conflict and kept it low throughout their work together. That didn't stop them from having task conflict at the outset. They didn't hesitate to surface competing perspectives. As they resolved some of their differences of opinion, they were able to align on a direction and carry out their work until they ran into new issues to debate. All in all, more than 100 studies have examined conflict types in over 8,000 teams. A meta-analysis of those studies showed that relationship conflict is generally bad for performance, but some task conflict can be beneficial. It's been linked to higher creativity and smarter choices. For example, there's evidence that when teams experience moderate task conflict early on, they generate more original ideas in Chinese technology companies, innovate more in Dutch delivery services, and make better decisions in American hospitals. As one research team concluded, the absence of conflict is not harmony, it's apathy. Relationship conflict is destructive in part because it stands in the way of rethinking. When a clash gets personal and emotional, we become self-righteous preachers of our own views, spiteful prosecutors of the other side, or single-minded politicians who dismiss opinions that don't come from our side. Task conflict can be constructive when it brings diversity of thought, preventing us from getting trapped in overconfidence cycles. It can help us stay humble, surface doubts, and make us curious about what we might be missing. That can lead us to think again, moving us closer to the truth without damaging our relationships. Although productive disagreement is a critical life skill, it's one that many of us never fully develop. The problem starts early. Parents disagree behind closed doors, fearing that conflict will make children anxious or somehow damage their character. Yet research shows that how often parents argue has no bearing on their children's academic, social, or emotional development. What matters is how respectfully parents argue, not how frequently. Kids whose parents clash constructively feel more emotionally safe in elementary school, and over the next few years, they actually demonstrate more helpfulness and compassion toward their classmates. Being able to have a good fight doesn't just make us more civil. It also develops our creative muscles. In a classic study, highly creative architects were more likely than their technically competent but less original peers to come from homes with plenty of friction. As psychologist Robert Albert notes, they often grew up in households that were, quote, tense but secure. The creative person to be comes from a family that is anything but harmonious, one with a wobble. The parents weren't physically or verbally abusive, but they didn't shy away from conflict either. Instead of telling their children to be seen but not heard, they encouraged them to stand up for themselves. The kids learned to dish it out and take it. That's exactly what happened to Wilbert and Orville Wright. When the Wright brothers said they thought together, what they really meant is that they fought together. Arguing was the family business. Although their father was a bishop in the local church, he included books by atheists in his library and encouraged the children to read and debate them. They developed the courage to fight for their ideas and the resilience to lose a disagreement without losing their resolve. When they were solving problems, they had arguments that lasted not just for hours, but for weeks and months at a time. They didn't have such incessant spats because they were angry. They kept quarreling because they enjoyed it and learned from the experience. As Wilbur reflected, "I like scrapping with Orv." As you'll see, it was one of their most passionate and prolonged arguments that led them to rethink a critical assumption that had prevented humans from soaring through the skies. As long as I can remember, I've been determined to keep the peace. Maybe it's because my group of friends dropped me in middle school. Maybe it's genetic. Maybe it's because my parents got divorced. Whatever the cause, in psychology, there's a name for my affliction. It's called agreeableness, and it's one of the major personality traits around the world. Agreeable people tend to be nice, friendly, polite, Canadian. Sure enough, in an analysis of over 40 million tweets, Americans were more likely than Canadians to use words like shit, bitch, hate, and damn, while Canadians favored more agreeable words like thanks, great, good, and sure. I grew up a short drive from the Canadian border in Michigan, and my first impulse is to avoid even the most trivial of conflicts. When I'm riding in an Uber and the air conditioning is blasting, I struggle to bring myself to ask the driver to turn it down. I just sit there shivering in silence until my teeth start to chatter. When someone steps on my shoe, I've actually apologized for inconveniently leaving my foot in his path. When students fill out course evaluations, one of their most common complaints is that I'm, quote, too supportive of stupid comments. Disagreeable people tend to be more critical, skeptical, and challenging, and they're more likely than their peers to become engineers and lawyers. They're not just comfortable with conflict, it energizes them. If you're highly disagreeable, you might be happier in an argument than in a friendly conversation. That quality often comes with a bad rap. Disagreeable people get stereotyped as curmudgeons who complain about every idea, or dementors who suck the joy out of every meeting. When I studied Pixar, though, I came away with a dramatically different view. In 2000, Pixar was on fire. Their teams had used computers to rethink animation in their first blockbuster, Toy Story, and they were fresh off two more smash hits. Yet the company's founders weren't content to rest on their laurels. They recruited an outside director named Brad Bird to shake things up. Brad had just released his debut film, which was well-reviewed but flopped at the box office, so he was itching to do something big and bold. When he pitched his vision, the technical leadership at Pixar said it was impossible. They would need a decade and $500 million to make it. Brad wasn't ready to give up. He sought out the biggest misfits at Pixar for his project. People who are disagreeable, disgruntled, and dissatisfied. Some call them black sheep. Others call them pirates. When Brad rounded them up, he warned them that no one believed they could pull off the project. Just 4 years later, his team didn't only succeed in releasing Pixar's most complex film ever. They actually managed to lower the cost of production per minute. The Incredibles went on to gross upwards of $631 million worldwide and won the Oscar for Best Animated Feature. Notice what Brad didn't do. He didn't stock his team with agreeable people. Agreeable people make for a great support network. They're excited to encourage us and cheerlead for us. Rethinking depends on a different kind of network, a challenge network, a group of people we trust to point out our blind spots and help us overcome our weaknesses. Their role is to activate rethinking cycles by pushing us to be humble about our expertise, doubt our knowledge, and be curious about new perspectives. The ideal members of a challenge network are disagreeable because they're fearless about questioning the way things have always been done and holding us accountable for thinking again. There's evidence that disagreeable people speak up more frequently, especially when leaders aren't receptive, and foster more task conflict. They're like the doctor in the show House, or the boss in the film The Devil Wears Prada. They give the critical feedback we might not want to hear, but need to hear. Harnessing disagreeable people isn't always easy. It helps if certain conditions are in place. Studies in oil drilling and tech companies suggest that dissatisfaction promotes creativity only when people feel committed and supported, and that cultural misfits are most likely to add value when they have strong bonds with their colleagues. Before Brad Bird arrived, Pixar already had a track record of encouraging talented people to push boundaries. But the studio's previous films had starred toys, bugs, and monsters, which were relatively simple to animate. Since making a whole film with lifelike human superheroes was beyond the capabilities of computer animation at the time, the technical teams balked at Brad's vision for The Incredibles. That's when he created his challenge network. He enlisted his band of pirates to foster task conflict and rethink the process. Brad gathered the pirates in Pixar's theater and told them that although a bunch of bean counters in corporate suits might not believe in them, he did. After rallying them, he went out of his way to seek their ideas. As Brad told me, "I want people who are disgruntled because they have a better way of doing things and they're having trouble finding an avenue. Racing cars that are just spinning their wheels in a garage rather than racing. You open that garage door, and man, those people will take you somewhere." The pirates rose to the occasion, finding economical alternatives to expensive techniques and easy workarounds for hard problems. When it came time to animate the superhero family, they didn't toil over the intricate contours of interlocking muscles. Instead, they figured out that sliding simple oval shapes against one another could become the building blocks of complex muscles. When I asked Brad how he recognized the value of pirates, he told me it was because he is one. Growing up, when he went to dinner at friends' houses, he was taken aback by the polite questions their parents asked about their day at school. Bird family dinners were more like a food fight, where they all vented, debated, and spoke their minds. Brad found the exchanges contentious but fun, and he brought that mentality into his first dream job at Disney. From an early age, he'd been mentored and trained by a group of old Disney masters to put quality first, and he was frustrated that their replacements, who now supervise the new generation at the studio, weren't upholding the same standards. Within a few months of launching his animation career at Disney, Brad was criticizing senior leaders for taking on conventional projects and producing substandard work. They told him to be quiet and do his job. When he refused, they fired him. I've watched too many leaders shield themselves from task conflict. As they gain power, they tune out boat rockers and listen to bootlickers. They become politicians, surrounding themselves with agreeable yes-men and becoming more susceptible to seduction by sycophants. Research reveals that when their firms perform poorly, CEOs who indulge flattery and conformity become overconfident. They stick to their existing strategic plans instead of changing course, which sets them on a collision course with failure. We learn more from people who challenge our thought process than those who affirm our conclusions. Strong leaders engage their critics and make themselves stronger. Weak leaders silence their critics and make themselves weaker. This reaction isn't limited to people in power. Although we might be on board with the principle, In practice, we often miss out on the value of a challenge network. In one experiment, when people were criticized rather than praised by a partner, they were over 4 times more likely to request a new partner. Across a range of workplaces, when employees received tough feedback from colleagues, their default response was to avoid those coworkers or drop them from their networks altogether, and their performance suffered over the following year. Some organizations and occupations counter those tendencies by building challenge networks into their cultures. From time to time, the Pentagon and the White House have used aptly named murder boards to stir up task conflict, enlisting tough-minded committees to shoot down plans and candidates. At X, Google's Moonshot Factory, there's a rapid evaluation team that's charged with rethinking proposals. Members conduct independent assessments and only advance the ones that emerge as both audacious and achievable. In science, a challenge network is often a cornerstone of the peer review process. We submit articles anonymously, and they're reviewed blindly by independent experts. I'll never forget the rejection letter I once received, in which one of the reviewers encouraged me to go back and read the work of Adam Grant. Dude, I am Adam Grant. When I write a book, I like to enlist my own challenge network. I recruit a group of my most thoughtful critics and ask them to tear each chapter apart. I've learned that it's important to consider their values along with their personalities. I'm looking for disagreeable people who are givers, not takers. Disagreeable givers often make the best critics. Their intent is to elevate the work, not feed their own egos. They don't criticize because they're insecure. They challenge because they care. They dish out tough love. Ernest Hemingway once said, "The most essential gift for a good writer is a built-in, shockproof shit detector." My challenge network is my shit detector. I think of it as a good fight club. The first rule, avoiding an argument is bad manners. Silence disrespects the value of your views and our ability to have a civil disagreement. Brad Bird lives by that rule. He has legendary arguments with his longstanding producer, John Walker. When making The Incredibles, they fought about every character detail, right down to their hair, from how receding the hairline should be on the superhero dad to whether the teenage daughter's hair should be long and flowing. At one point, Brad wanted the baby to morph into goo, taking on a jelly-like shape, but John put his foot down. It would be too difficult to animate, and they were too far behind schedule. John said, laughing, "I'm just trying to herd you toward the finish. I'm just trying to get us across the line, man." Pounding his fist, Brad shot back, "I'm trying to get us across the line in first place." Eventually, John talked Brad out of it, and the goo was gone. Brad says, "I love working with John because he'll give me the bad news straight to my face. It's good that we disagree. It's good that we fight it out. It makes the stuff stronger." Those fights have helped Brad win 2 Oscars and made him a better learner and a better leader. For John's part, he didn't flat out refuse to animate a gooey baby. He just told Brad he would have to wait a little bit. Sure enough, when they got around to releasing a sequel to The Incredibles 14 years later, the baby got into a fight with a raccoon and transformed into goo. That scene might be the hardest I've ever seen my kids laugh. Hashing out competing views has potential downsides, risks that need to be managed. On the first Incredibles film, a rising star named Nicole Grindle had managed the simulation of the hair, watching John and Brad's interactions from a distance. When Nicole came in to produce the sequel with John, one of her concerns was that the volume of the arguments between the two highly accomplished leaders might drown out the voices of people who were less comfortable speaking up: newcomers, introverts, women, and minorities. It's common for people who lack power or status to shift into politician mode, suppressing their dissenting views in favor of conforming to the HIPPO, the highest paid person's opinion. Sometimes they have no other choice if they want to survive. To make sure their desire for approval didn't prevent them from introducing task conflict, Nicole encouraged new people to bring their divergent ideas to the table. Some voiced them directly to the group. Others went to her for feedback and support. Although Nicole wasn't a pirate, as she found herself advocating for different perspectives, she became more comfortable challenging Brad on characters and dialogue. As she put it to me, "Brad is still the ornery guy who first came to Pixar, so you have to be ready for a spirited debate when you put forward a contrary point of view." The notion of a spirited debate captures something important about how and why good fights happen. If you watch Brad argue with his colleagues, or the pirates fight with one another, you can quickly see that the tension is intellectual, not emotional. The tone is vigorous and feisty, rather than combative or aggressive. They don't disagree just for the sake of it. They disagree because they care. As Nicole explains, whether you disagree loudly or quietly yet persistently put forward a different perspective, we come together to support the common goal of excellence, of making great films. After seeing their interactions up close, I finally understood what had long felt like a contradiction in my own personality, how I could be highly agreeable and still cherish a good argument. Agreeableness is about seeking social harmony, not cognitive consensus. It's possible to disagree without being disagreeable. Although I'm terrified of hurting other people's feelings, when it comes to challenging their thoughts, I have no fear. In fact, when I argue with someone, it's not a display of disrespect. It's a sign of respect. It means I value their views enough to contest them. If their opinions didn't matter to me, I wouldn't bother. I know I have chemistry with someone when we find it delightful to prove each other wrong. Agreeable people don't always steer clear of conflict. They're highly attuned to the people around them and often adapt to the norms in the room. My favorite demonstration is an experiment by my colleagues Jennifer Chapman and Sigal Barsaid. Agreeable people were significantly more accommodating than disagreeable ones, as long as they were in a cooperative team. When they were assigned to a competitive team, they acted just as disagreeably as their disagreeable teammates. That's how working with Brad Bird influenced John Walker. John's natural tendency is to avoid conflict. At restaurants, if the waiter brings him the wrong dish, he just goes ahead and eats it anyway. But as he observes, when I'm involved in something bigger than myself, I feel like I have an opportunity, a responsibility really, to speak up, speak out, debate. Fight like hell when the morning whistle blows, but go out for a beer after the one at 5 o'clock. That adaptability was also visible in the Wright brothers' relationship. In Wilbur, Orville had a built-in challenge network. Wilbur was known to be highly disagreeable. He was unfazed by other people's opinions and had a habit of pouncing on anyone else's idea the moment it was raised. Orville was known as gentle, cheerful, and sensitive to criticism. Yet those qualities seemed to vanish in his partnership with his brother. As Wilbur said, "He's such a good scrapper." One sleepless night, Orville came up with an idea to build a rudder that was movable rather than fixed. The next morning at breakfast, as he got ready to pitch the idea to Wilbur, Orville winked at a colleague of theirs, expecting Wilbur to go into challenge mode and demolish it. Much to his surprise, Wilbur saw the potential in the idea immediately, and it became one of their major discoveries. Disagreeable people don't just challenge us to think again. They also make agreeable people comfortable arguing too. Instead of fleeing from friction, our grumpy colleagues engage it directly. By making it clear that they can handle a tussle, they create a norm for the rest of us to follow. If we're not careful, though, what starts as a scuffle can turn into a brawl. How can we avoid that slippery slope? A major problem with task conflict is that it often spills over into relationship conflict. One minute, you're disagreeing about how much seasoning to put on the Thanksgiving turkey, and the next minute, you find yourself yelling, "You smell!" Although the Wright brothers had a lifetime of experience discovering each other's hot buttons, that didn't mean they always kept their cool. Their last grand challenge before liftoff was their single hardest problem, designing a propeller. They knew their airplane couldn't take flight without one, but the right kind didn't exist. As they struggled with various approaches, they argued back and forth for hours at a time, often raising their voices. The feuding lasted for months as each took turns preaching the merits of his own solutions and prosecuting the other's points. Eventually, their younger sister, Catherine, threatened to leave the house if they didn't stop fighting. They kept at it anyway, until one night it culminated in what might have been the loudest shouting match of their lives. Strangely, the next morning, they came into the shop and acted as if nothing had happened. They picked up the argument about the propeller right where they had left off, only now without the yelling. Soon, they were both rethinking their assumptions and stumbling onto what would become one of their biggest breakthroughs. The Wright brothers were masters at having intense task conflict without relationship conflict. When they raised their voices, it reflected intensity rather than hostility. As their mechanic marveled, "I don't think they really got mad, but they sure got awfully hot." Experiments show that simply framing a dispute as a debate rather than as a disagreement signals that you're receptive to considering dissenting opinions and changing your mind, which in turn motivates the other person to share more information with you. A disagreement feels personal and potentially hostile. We expect a debate to be about ideas, not emotions. Starting a disagreement by asking, "Can we debate?" sends a message that you want to think like a scientist, not a preacher or a prosecutor, and encourages the other person to think that way too. The Wright brothers had the benefit of growing up in a family where disagreements were seen as productive and enjoyable. When arguing with others, though, they often had to go out of their way to reframe their behavior. As Wilbur once wrote to a colleague whose ego was bruised after a fiery exchange about aeronautics, "Honest argument is merely a process of mutually picking the beams and motes out of each other's eyes so both can see clearly." Wilbur stressed that it wasn't personal. He saw arguments as opportunities to test and refine their thinking. Quote, "I see that you are back at your old trick of giving up before you are half beaten in an argument. I feel pretty certain of my own ground, but was anticipating the pleasure of a good scrap before the matter was settled. Discussion brings out new ways of looking at things." When they argued about the propeller, the Wright brothers were making a common mistake. Each was preaching about why he was right and why the other was wrong. When we argue about why, we run the risk of becoming emotionally attached to our positions and dismissive of the other sides. We're more likely to have a good fight if we argue about how. When social scientists ask people why they favor particular policies on taxes, healthcare, or nuclear sanctions, they often double down on their convictions. Asking people to explain how those policies would work in practice, or how they'd explain them to an expert, activated a rethinking cycle. They noticed gaps in their knowledge, doubted their conclusions, and became less extreme. They were now more curious about alternative options. Psychologists find that many of us are vulnerable to an illusion of explanatory depth. Take everyday objects like a bicycle, a piano, or the earbuds you might be listening to this book on. How well do you understand them? People tend to be overconfident in their knowledge. They believe they know much more than they actually do about how these objects work. We can help them see the limits of their understanding by asking them to unpack the mechanisms. How do the gears on a bike work? How does a piano key make music? How do earbuds transmit my voice to your ears? People are surprised by how much they struggle to answer those questions and quickly realize how little they actually know. That's what happened to the Wright brothers after their yelling match. The next morning, the Wright brothers approached the propeller problem differently. Orville showed up at the shop first and told their mechanic that he had been wrong. They should design the propeller Wilbur's way. Then Wilbur arrived and started arguing against his own idea, suggesting that Orville might be right. As they shifted into scientist mode, they focused less on why different solutions would succeed or fail, and more on how those solutions might work. Finally, they identified problems with both of their approaches and realized they were both wrong. As Orville wrote, "We worked out a theory of our own on the subject and soon discovered that all the propellers built heretofore are all wrong." He exclaimed that their new design was, quote, "all right, till we have the chance to test them down at Kitty Hawk and find out differently." Even after building a better solution, they were still open to rethinking it. At Kitty Hawk, they found that it was indeed the right one. The Wright brothers had figured out that their airplane didn't need a propeller. It needed two propellers, spinning in opposite directions, to function like a rotating wing. That's the beauty of task conflict. In a great argument, our adversary is not a foil, but a propeller. With twin propellers spinning in divergent directions, our thinking doesn't get stuck on the ground. It takes flight.